Listener, can we talk about beds? There is nothing better than crawling into one that feels just right. Soft sheets, the perfect weight, everything a little more comfortable than you expected. That is what I get from Quince. Their bedding feels seriously elevated, the stuff you would find at a nice hotel, at a price that almost feels like a typo. The European linen sheets are woven from a high-quality flax and get softer every wash. And the mulberry silk pillowcases, those are the small upgrade you actually notice. Smoother hair, happier skin in the morning. The reason it is so affordable is that Quince works directly with ethical manufacturers and cuts out the middlemen, so you are paying for quality, not markup. I use this, and you should too. Refresh your everyday with luxury you can actually use. Head to quince.com/obscura for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/obscura for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/obscura. In the winter of 1971, in the woods on the outskirts of Troy, Michigan, a 15-year-old girl was living in a sleeping bag in the snow. She had a small clearing she had picked out for herself, a fire pit she had dug, a few items of clothing in a plastic bag, cigarettes when she could trade for them. The patch of woods around her was hers in a way that nothing in her life up to that point had ever really been, which is to say, hers because nobody else had bothered to claim it. 4 months earlier, she had given birth to a son in a Detroit home for unwed mothers. The boy had been taken from her almost immediately and placed for adoption. A few weeks before that, her grandmother had died of liver failure. A few weeks after that, her grandfather had thrown her out of the house. Her mother had walked out on her when she was almost 4 years old and had never come back. Her father, a man she had never met, had hanged himself in a Michigan prison cell 2 years earlier, while serving a life sentence for raping a 7-year-old girl. Her face was scarred from a fire she had been in at age 6. Her IQ, when it would eventually be measured, was 81. She had stopped going to school. She had no money. There was no adult on the planet looking out for her. What she had was a sleeping bag in the snow. Her name was Eileen Carol Pittman. The world would come to know her by her grandparents' last name, Warnos. By the time most people heard that name on the news, she was 34 years old, sitting in a Florida courtroom, accused of shooting 7 men to death along the highways of Central Florida between 1989 and 1990. The press called her the first female serial killer in the United States, which is not quite accurate historically, but is the line that traveled. Hollywood made a movie about her that won Charlize Theron an Academy Award. The state of Florida strapped her to a gurney in October of 2002, but we'll get to that. None of that has happened yet. Not tonight, listener. Tonight there are no bodies on the side of any highway. There's no Tyra Moore, no Last Resort Bar, no Richard Mallory, no Death Row. There is a girl who started at the bottom of a hole most of us cannot really imagine the shape of from the outside, and who, by age 15, was already sleeping in the woods. This is part one of a 4-part series. We are going to walk her childhood slowly. The transient years, the murders, the trial, Death Row. All of that is coming in later episodes, but you cannot understand any of it without first understanding the girl in the sleeping bag. All right, let's get on with it.
Maybe you were just born bad.
I don't know about you. I'm telling you, man. No, I wasn't born bad. You guys got it. See, I'm trying to tell you, man, they lied. They lied so bad to you all.
But you've been convicted of killing 7 men.
Everybody's looking at the number.
Does that not... You killed 7 men, 7 strangers. Does that not make you a serial killer?
So I didn't kill them every day, did I? Did I go out there every day and say, I'm going to kill... If I did, there would
be hundreds. Well, no, it took you 12 months.
Yeah. And that's a hell of a lot of men I went through before the next jerk came along, and I used protection, like a condom.
So it was AIDS. It was self-defense?
Yeah.
Well, the first one, perhaps, the second, maybe, but 7 times?
So what?
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat, next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Chapter 1, A Bad Inheritance. Diane Warnos was 14 years old when she married Leo Dale Pittman on June 3rd, 1954. 14. Picture a 14-year-old girl you know, listener. A child in middle school. A kid still figuring out how to ask for a bathroom pass. That was Eileen's mother on her wedding day. Leo Pittman, the groom, was a few years older, and he was, by every available account, a deeply violent young man. He had what we would today recognize as serious untreated mental illness, eventually diagnosed as schizophrenia. The descriptions of him that survived the years come from people who knew him as a kid, and the descriptions are bad. He used to entertain himself by tying two cats together by their tails and throwing them over a clothesline so he could watch them fight. He beat the grandmother who had raised him after his own mother abandoned him in infancy. There was a long history of cruelty before he was ever an adult. The fact that any institution looked at this young man and signed off on him marrying a 14-year-old girl is a sentence I have to type because the historical record demands it, but it should make you angry. Diane and Leo had a son. They named him Keith. The marriage was already collapsing by the time Diane became pregnant a second time. She was 18, with a one-year-old at her hip, and Leo was already on his way to a series of mental hospitals and prisons he was never going to come back from. On February 29, 1956, in Rochester, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, Diane gave birth to a baby girl, Eileen Pittman. Eileen never met her father. In 1967, Leo Pittman was sentenced to life imprisonment for kidnapping and rape of a 7-year-old girl. 2 years later, on January 30th, 1969, he hanged himself in his cell. He died never having laid eyes on his own daughter.
Well, I heard that he raped a 7-year-old girl, and so I didn't really care. He raped a little girl and killed her, and it didn't. Anybody who rapes, to me, is a sick, deranged piece of puke that doesn't even deserve to live.
And Eileen would only ever know him as a stack of newspaper clippings and family rumors that, on some level, she was expected to inherit. That is one of the cruelest pieces of psychic furniture a child can be handed. The knowledge that, before you are old enough to vote, that the man whose blood is in you was the kind of man who raped a 7-year-old child. Eileen carried with her that knowledge for the rest of her life, and at various points, she wondered out loud what it was supposed to mean about her. Diane, the teenage mother, did the math early. 19 years old, 2 crying babies, no husband, no future. She did not handle it well. She was overwhelmed and depressed, and almost certainly dealing with what would today be called postpartum depression, on top of being a kid raising other kids alone. In January of 1960, when Eileen was almost 4, Diane left. She handed the children off briefly to a friend named Marge. Marge handed them, in turn, to Diane's parents, Lori and Britta Warnos. Lori and Britta legally adopted both kids on March 18, 1960. Diane went on with her life and would not be a meaningful presence in either child's life again for many years. Here's one of the strange and quietly cruel facts at the center of this story, listener. Lori and Britta did not tell the children they were grandparents. They simply raised them as their own. Eileen called Lori Daddy growing up. She called Britta Mom. The two older children in the house, who were actually her biological aunt and uncle, were presented to her as her older brother and sister. The whole structure of her family in her child mind was a story the adults around her had agreed she was not entitled to know the shape of. That story was going to come apart, the way stories like that do. But before it came apart, the harm had already started.
You understand that for many people, because you were a prostitute, they don't understand how a prostitute can be raped.
I don't understand how nobody can understand that how a prostitute can be raped. Because when a man rapes a woman, he assaults your whole body. He puts his down your throat, cramming it down your throat. He tears your hair out of your head. He beats your face in. He rips your wide open.
Chapter 2, The Fire. She was 6 years old. The year was 1962. Eileen and Keith, the two younger children in the Warnos house, were doing what bored Midwestern kids with too little supervision have done since the invention of childhood. They were playing with fire. They had gotten their hands on a can of lighter fluid and a few matches. They were in the yard or close to it, depending on the version. Lighter fluid does not behave the way regular accelerant does. It jumps, it takes off. It does in a tenth of a second what a careful match would not do in a minute. The lighter fluid jumped. Eileen's face caught. A six-year-old's first instinct when their face is on fire is to scream and run. Running, of course, is the worst possible thing, because running feeds the flames more oxygen. By the time the adults in her life got to her, Eileen's face had been seriously burned. She received the medical attention an alcoholic, distracted working-class household in 1962 was inclined to give a six-year-old. She recovered. The scarring did not. She carried marks on her face for the rest of her life from the day she was six, and her face had been on fire. A scarred face is the kind of thing that follows a child through every social interaction they ever have, especially in a culture that treats female beauty as a kind of currency that gets collected at the door. Classmates were going to comment on her face. Family was going to comment on her face. The mirror was going to comment on her face every morning. A small girl who has been burned in the yard at six was going to grow into a woman who was always a little outside the visual rules her culture wanted to enforce on her. There is also the question fire raises about the household. Fire is not a subtle event. A six-year-old getting seriously burned because nobody was watching her closely enough to keep a can of lighter fluid out of her hands is exactly the sort of moment that should have triggered some kind of inquiry from the adults at the edge of the family. Any system working the way a system should work would have asked what kind of supervision Eileen and Keith were operating under, and whether the household around them was, at the most fundamental of levels, safe. No such inquiry happened. Nobody knocked on the door of Lori and Britta's house and asked them to account for what had happened to that little girl in their care. The fire was a signal that nobody chose to read. The Warnos home was a small post-war ranch house, the kind that went up across the Detroit suburbs by the thousands in the 1950s. A few bedrooms, a kitchen with a wooden table in the middle of it, a front yard with a little grass, a driveway, neighbors close enough that they would have heard a child screaming. The houses on that block were not soundproofed. Single-pane windows. If a child was being beaten in a kitchen on a Sunday afternoon, the neighbors on either side would have known. Nobody on that block ever called anything in. That was the polite agreement at the time. Eyes on your own driveway, no matter what was leaking out of the house next to you. Inside that small house, the rules were Lori's rules.
Help should have been there a long time ago.
In her case, okay? Yes, sir.
She was venting some of the hurt encountered during her childhood. That's the way I feel.
I think that she shouldn't be able to die. I think she should have to suffer. It's the easy way out.
Interesting. Yes, sir.
There is no justification for murder. It's as simple as that. And what difference does it make whether he's a missionary or not? He's a human being.
Okay.
I think her abuse led to her acting like she did. I think she could maybe be saved by with some therapy instead of the electric chair.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I don't think she set out to do it, but she should be killed for what, you know, she killed them. She should have set the death to.
Yes.
I agree with the lady. The death penalty is the easy way out.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I think if she was found guilty and she wants a death penalty, she should get it.
Prostitution should be banned, and I don't think she should die.
I'm against the death penalty, and I don't understand why there are not more reforms in prison. There should be more, you know.
Yeah. I think if she underwent some serious therapy, she may change her mind.
Therapy. I feel she just did it for defending herself.
Okay.
If she did it once, why didn't she get help then?
I think she should have to suffer.
Chapter 3, The Belt. Lori Warnos, the man raising Eileen as her father, while telling her he was her father, was an alcoholic. The drinking was not occasional, listener. It was structural. It shaped his evenings, his weekends, his temperament. The version of Lori that was at home with the children was the drunk version of Lori more often than it was the sober one. Britta drank too, but hers was the quieter kind, the version of alcoholism that ate at the liver but did not raise a hand. His was the alcoholism that did. Lori was what an earlier generation of Americans would have called a strict disciplinarian, a phrase that has always done a lot of work for covering up something darker. The instrument he used was a black leather belt, doubled over for impact, the way a belt has to be folded when the person swinging it knows what they are doing. The beatings followed a procedure. The procedure has been documented in court records, in trial testimony, in interviews Eileen gave during her competency evaluations later in life, and in accounts from a childhood friend named Dawn Bodkins. Eileen would be told to take her shorts off. She would be told to bend over the wooden table in the middle of the kitchen. Sometimes, instead, she would be told to lie face down, naked, spread-eagled on a bed. The belt would come down. By Dawn Bodkins' eyewitness account, in one beating she personally saw, it came down for 5 minutes. Count that out in your head. Count to 20 now. Go ahead, pause. Or, if you will, do the full 300 seconds. And imagine leather meeting the skin. 300 seconds of a child counting in her head and trying to be quiet about it, lest it rain down more. There is also, in the family record, the kitten. The story comes from Eileen herself in later interviews, and she didn't have a lot to lose at the time, and it has been corroborated in the broad strokes by other accounts. At one point in her childhood, Lori made Eileen watch him drown a kitten. It is a small detail. It is also one of those details that lodges itself in the architecture of who a child becomes. A child made to watch an adult kill a small animal, made to watch on purpose, is a child being taught something specific. The lesson being taught is, this is what I'm capable of, and I can do this to any small and helpless thing in this house. And you are a small and helpless thing in this house. There's no version of that lesson delivered to a child that does not stick. Eileen brought the kitten up more than once when she was finally able to talk about her childhood. In her later statement, Eileen also said her grandfather sexually abused her. She said the abuse started when she was young. She said that before he beat her, he would force her to undress. The forcing of the undressing was part of his method, and the entanglement of beating and nudity is in itself a kind of violence. A child being made to take their clothes off as a precondition to being struck is a child whose body is being colonized in two directions at the same time. They are not safe in their skin while clothed. They are not safe in their skin while naked. There's no posture they can take that is safe. There's no compliance that will spare them.
Does the brain actually change? Does something happen in the brain that leaves a scar as a result of this? And in fact, the current literature talks about the anatomy of the brain. And if we look at the brain as something that's rich and promising and wonderful at birth, and then we expose that brain to all these sorts of things, so this is what happens. The hippocampus gets smaller. Corpus callosum is smaller. In fact, this is very significant, that white matter connection between the two sides of the brain. In adults who've grown up in adverse environments as children, corpus callosum is smaller. Now, why should that be? There's less connection between the two sides of the brain, less synapses. But what happens when a child grows up in an environment where, in fact, the threat is continuous and repeated? Well, what happens is then that CRF is chronically stimulated, corticotropic releasing hormone, and cortisol remains high. It never gets the cycle backwards where it shuts off and turns off. And what happens with this is it sort of blunts this whole system. It doesn't work very well. So everything kind of gets out of balance. And when things are out of balance, the brain doesn't grow the same way.
Then you have the verbal cruelty, in which Lori reportedly told Eileen with regularity that she was evil, that she was worthless, and that she did not deserve to live. Think about the impact of those three sentences delivered to a child, daily, for years, by the person a child believes to be her father. A child does not have the developmental equipment to argue with an adult on those points. A child internalizes those sentences as facts about herself. By the time Eileen was 9, 10, 11 years old, she was carrying a self-image that had been hammered into her by the man who was supposed to be the foundation of her self-image. She was not just hurt, listener. In the language she had been given for herself, she was a piece of trash that her own father did not believe should have been born. And then she found out he was not her father. Chapter 4, The Truth About the House. There are different versions of the moment Eileen learned the truth. Some accounts put her at 11, some at 12. Some say it happened in a single shattering conversation. Some say it happened gradually, in fragments pieced together. The most common version is that, somewhere around 11 or 12, Eileen and Keith both came to understand that Lori and Britta were not their parents. They were their grandparents. Listener, after diving deep into another true crime story, I've been loving a little wind-down ritual at the end of the night. And that's exactly why I'm obsessed with Mood. Mood is the online spot for federally legal, hemp-derived cannabis grown on small, pesticide-free family farms right here in the U.S. They ship gummies, flower, edibles, pre-rolls, and more discreetly, straight to your door. No lines, no hassle. They've got something for every vibe. Chill for sleep, focused for deep work, happy and euphoric when you just want to feel good, or even that extra spark for better sex. My go-to lately, their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. Super smooth, mind-soothing calm that kicks in fast and leaves me waking up clear. No grogginess. Perfect after a long day. And right now, first-time buyers get 20% off your entire order when you use my code OBSCURA at checkout. Head to mood.com, find the gummy, flower, or edible that matches your perfect mood, and save 20% off with code OBSCURA. Everything's backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. Go to mood.com/obscura and try it today. Listener, how many supplements do you take that you actually know are working? Because for years, I was just buying whatever sounded good on the label and hoping for the best. That is exactly why I love True Diagnostic. It is an at-home health test that takes the guessing out of all of it. With one quick finger prick at home, True Diagnostic measures up to 180 biomarkers and analyzes over 1 million data points to tell you what your body actually needs right now. You get digital results back with a personalized 90-day action plan, 3 real recommendations to follow, and then you retest to see your progress. No generic advice, no influencer fads, just real data from advanced epigenetic testing that is trusted by top longevity clinics. Honestly, my younger self would have benefited from this. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code OBSCURA20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use OBSCURA20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. The two other children in the house were not their older siblings. They were their aunt and uncle. Their actual mother was a woman named Diane who had walked away from them years earlier, never to come back. Picture being 11 years old and learning that. At 11, a child is capable of doing the math on the years they have spent calling someone mom and dad, and recognizing that those years were, in some structural way, a lie. For Eileen, the math went one direction. If Lori was not her father, then who was? The answer when she found it, of course, was the man named Leo Pittman, a man who, by the time she found him, was already 2 years dead in a prison cell, hanged from his own hands, after a life sentence for raping a little girl. If Britta was not her mother, then who was? The answer was a teenager named Diane, who had abandoned her at age 4 to go live whatever life Diane had decided to go live instead, without her. That is the package an 11-year-old girl in Troy, Michigan, opened at around 1967. Father dead by suicide, mother left her alone. The brother she had grown up with was in fact her brother, but everyone else in the house had a different relationship to her than what she had been told. Something inside Eileen, by every available account, broke at that point. Not loudly, but quietly. She was already a child with what people in her life called an explosive temper. She was already a child who had trouble making friends. She was already a child whose face had been burned, and whose body had been beaten, and whose self-image had been hollowed out by years of being told she was worthless. The discovery that the foundation of her family was a lie was not the first injury. It was the injury that compromised an already weakened structure. She started to act out. Truancy, tantrums, running away. The school records from her middle school describe a child who was, in the language of educators used at the time, becoming difficult. Her hearing began to give her trouble. Her vision began to give her trouble. Some of these issues were almost certainly the result of physical abuse. Some were almost certainly the result of nutrition or the lack of it. In a household where the adults were drunk more often than not. And then of course her low IQ, coming in at 81. That is on the low end of dull normal range. It is not intellectual disability. It is not the cliff. But it is the kind of cognitive baseline that, paired with everything else she was carrying, was going to make every adult system she had ever encountered harder to navigate than it would have been for a brighter, more verbally agile peer. The school years are the years when, in a healthier story, an institution might have caught her. Eileen attended public school in Troy. She had teachers, nurses, counselors. School in 1967 was not the trauma-informed environments they sometimes are now, but they were not blind either. A child whose face was scarred from fire, whose performance was deteriorating, whose hearing and vision were declining, whose attendance was inconsistent, whose social behavior was already being noted by classmates with a nickname I will get to in a minute, whose home life was an open secret, was a child sending up flares in every direction a child knows how to send them up. None of those flares were answered. The institutional response to Eileen's distress was, at best, to label her a behavior problem, and at worst, to push her further out of the system. Adults have a way of writing certain children off, and once a child has been written off, the writing tends to stick. By 11, Eileen was, by any reasonable measure, a child in a state of ongoing emergency. There was no safety in her home. There was no nurturing in her home. There was no truthfulness in her home. There was a belt and there was a bottle. There was a grandfather who told her that she did not deserve to live. And then there was a school where she did not fit in and a face she did not recognize in the mirror. So she found the only currency she had been taught how to use, and she started spending it.
Because you were a prostitute. They don't understand how a prostitute can be raped.
Chapter 5, The Cigarette Pig. I want to handle this section with care, because the version of Eileen that gets stuck in pop culture often starts here, and it almost always starts here without the proper framing. By the time she was 11, Eileen had figured out something about her own body that the adults in her life had been telling her in various ways. Since she had been small, she had figured out that her body was a thing that could be exchanged. She had grown up in a household where one of the primary ways an adult engaged with her body was to demand that she undress. She had grown up with the knowledge that her father had been a sexual predator who had targeted children, that even her relationship with her brother had crossed lines that no relationship between siblings should cross. The lesson her childhood was teaching her in a thousand quiet ways, was that her body was not really hers. Her body was a kind of common property, available to whoever wanted it, and she did not have the standing to refuse. So at age 11, Eileen started doing a version of what she had been taught. She began offering sexual favors to boys at school in exchange for cigarettes, drugs, and food. The boys called her, behind her back and increasingly to her face, the cigarette pig. I'm not going to soften that nickname. It is in the historical record. It is in the testimony. It is in the trial transcript. It is one of the names an 11-year-old girl carried throughout her middle school years, attached to her by classmates who, at 11 and 12, were not capable yet of understanding what they were watching, which was a child being colonized by an entire ecology of harm. The nickname tells you something about the social pressure she was under, It also tells you something about what 11-year-old boys in Troy, Michigan in 1967 were comfortable doing in front of each other to a girl whose face was scarred and whose home was unsafe. I want to be very precise about something here, because I have seen this discussed badly in too many places, and I don't want to leave it uncorrected. Let's make this clear, listener. An 11-year-old girl is not a sex worker. An 11-year-old girl is, in every legal and moral framework that exists, a child being sexually exploited. The boys who took advantage of her hunger and her need for affection and her cigarettes and drugs were not customers. They were committing abuse. The fact that the adult Eileen would later, in her own voice, describe these years in the language of her sex work career does not change what was happening. A child cannot consent. A child trading her body for cigarettes is not making an economic decision. She is doing the only thing the adults around her have shown her how to do.
I made a lot of friends, mm-hmm. and I loved it. I loved it. Yeah, I loved the social communication. I loved the sex. I loved the fun we had. I loved the communication we had. I liked the friendship.
Do you understand that for some people, they would find that strange? In other words, that they couldn't imagine getting love and attention in that way.
I don't understand what's so strange about it. You just made a bunch of friends. So what?
What Eileen was doing at 11 was a textbook description of the long-term effects of childhood sexual abuse. Children who are sexualized too early often reenact the dynamic on their own, because reenacting it gives them a sense of control they did not have when it was being done to them. The 11-year-old offering favors for cigarettes is the 11-year-old who has been taught by her father figure and by her body's history that this is the transaction her existence is structured around. She was not pioneering anything. She was repeating what the people around her had already done to her. By her early teens, the pattern was a fixture of her social life. She was a name spoken about behind hands at school. The girls disapproved. The boys took advantage. The teachers, presumably, noticed and did nothing about it. The household she went home to every night was still the household with the belt and the bottle. There was no off-ramp. There was no point of intervention. Nobody in her orbit ever looked at her and said, "That child is in trouble, and we are going to do something about it." She was 13 by some accounts, or 14 by others, when she got pregnant. The story Eileen told at different points in her life was that the pregnancy was the result of a rape, and that the rapist had been a friend of Lori's. Other times she told a different story. Other times the story shifted. The fluidity of her account is itself a feature of the trauma she was carrying. People who survive sustained childhood sexual abuse rarely have a clean narrative about who did what to them and on which date. The brain does not file those events the way it files a vacation. It files them in fragments that survivors spend the rest of their lives trying to reassemble. Whatever the truth of that specific event was, the result was concrete. Eileen was a 14-year-old girl with a pregnancy. Lori did what Lori did. He sent her away. She was taken to a home for unwed mothers in Detroit. She gave birth to a baby boy on March 23rd, 1971. He was taken from her almost immediately and given up for adoption. She would never see him again. She did not get to name him. She did not get to hold him in any meaningful or ongoing sense. She was 14 years old when she became a mother, and 14 years old when motherhood was taken from her. And she went home from that hospital with empty arms and a body still recovering, and that same grandfather waiting on the other side of the door. That child is alive somewhere right now. He would be in his mid-50s. Whether or not he ever knew who his biological mother was, whether or not he had ever connected the dots between his birth records and the woman who became one of the most famous death row inmates in American history, is not part of the public record, and it is not my business to speculate about. What is my business to say on this show is that he existed, he was real, he was the only blood relation Eileen Wuornos ever produced, and they had each other for less time than it took for me to write this segment, or for me to record it on Mother's Day, listener. Chapter 6, The Year Everything Broke. 1971 broke open whatever was left. In March, the baby was born and given up. Eileen came home from the home for unwed mothers and dropped out of school not long after. She was 15 by then. No diploma, no job, no support. The only relationship in the house that had ever been a real anchor for her, her bond with her brother Keith, was complicated by years of intermittent intimacy that had blurred lines that should never have been blurred. The other relationships in the house were unsalvageable. In July of 1971, Britta Warnos died. The official cause was liver failure. She was an alcoholic, and her liver had given up on her. The night she died, she was reportedly having convulsions. Lori, by some accounts, did not call an ambulance in time, and family members said it was because he could not afford one. Other family members would later allege that he had killed her. Diane, the daughter who had walked out years earlier, was among the people who believed Lori had killed his own wife. Though no charges were ever brought, and no autopsy ever supported a homicide finding, the death stood as a death from cirrhosis. The funeral happened. Britta was gone. The thing about Britta is that even though she had not protected Eileen from Lori, even though she had been silent in the next room when the bell came down, she had been the only marginally maternal figure Eileen had. Britta baked. Britta cooked. Britta was occasionally kind. The household, for all its violence, had at least had a woman in it who once in a while spoke gently. With Britta gone, the last softening influence in that house was gone, and what was left was Lori, drinking harder than ever, with a 15-year-old granddaughter he had been telling for years was worthless and did not deserve to live. It goes without saying that he did not want her there. A few weeks after the funeral, Lori threw Eileen out of the house. That is the line that should stop you. A man whose wife had just died, who was responsible for raising a 15-year-old girl, who had just been forced to give up a child, who had been beating that girl since she was small, looked at her and decided that the loss of his wife was the appropriate moment to expel his granddaughter from his home. There was no ceremony. There was no plan. There was no place she was being sent to. There was no relative she was being delivered to. He simply made it clear that she could not stay. So, she went to the woods. There were woods on the edge of Troy, patches of trees behind the development, wooded lots that backed up against the highway. Eileen knew them. She had been wandering them for years. She had a sleeping bag. She had a few belongings. She had whatever she had managed to take with her from the house when Lori's mood had broken open. She walked into the trees, made a clearing, and stayed there. She was 15 years old, the age at which most kids are studying for learner's permits. In arguing with their parents about curfew, Eileen was sleeping in the woods, supporting herself by sex work in cars and motels, at the edges of parking lots, eating when she could, drinking when she could, trying to keep warm through a Michigan winter in a sleeping bag in a clearing. The neighborhood, by some accounts, knew she was out there. Her former classmates knew. A few of them brought her food. Others did not. Some of them, including the boys who had called her the cigarette pig in middle school, knew exactly where to find her when they wanted to find her. And the visits to her clearing were not always the visits of friends. The woods did not protect her from the people who had been hurting her in the school hallways. The woods just relocated the harm to a quieter setting. By the time spring came, she spent months in those trees. She had cycled through illnesses she did not see a doctor for. She had been hungry for stretches that most adult listeners to this show have never experienced. She had grown into the shape of a person who knows at a level deeper than language that no one is coming for her. That winter is the cold open for this series. The girl in the snow, the fire pit, the plastic bag of clothes, the face with burn scars, the body that had carried a child months earlier. The girl was alone. She was not, in any practical sense, a citizen of the city of Troy. She was a feral child. She was the byproduct of every system that had been supposed to catch her and had instead waved her on through. Michigan in 1971 did have child protective services. It did have laws about truancy and homelessness and the welfare of minors. None of those systems found Eileen. She existed marginalized outside them in a way that we look back on now with disbelief, because we like to think of ourselves as living in a society that in its imperfect way, watches out for its children. The truth is that in that decade, in that suburb, in that economic class, a 15-year-old girl could vanish into a sleeping bag in the woods. And the only people who would notice were a few former classmates, a few of the men and cars she was getting into, and a childhood friend named Dawn Botkins. By the end of 1971, Eileen Warnos was 15 years old. Her father had been dead for 2 years. Her grandmother had been dead for a few months. Her brother was alive, but their relationship was a wound. Her grandfather had thrown her out and would, in less than 5 years, kill himself the same way her father had, by his own hand. Her mother was somewhere in the country, living a separate life. Her son was somewhere in the country, being raised by someone not her. Her face scarred, her body used. Her self-image had been hammered for 15 years by an adult who told her she was evil, that she was worthless. Her education was over, her childhood was over. In part two, we follow Eileen through the next 18 years. The hitchhiking, the cross-country trips, arrests. In part three, I'll walk you through the bodies. A 12-month period. We will walk the cars, the wooded areas, the investigation, videotaped confessions. And then part four will close the series. The trial in Volusia County and everything that followed that. What will this all mean? That question does not have a clean answer. We are not going to give it one. We are going to give it the full weight it deserves, in both directions, because both directions are real. But that is it for the next three episodes. Tonight, before I let you go, this is where I'm going to leave you tonight, with the understanding that by the time she was old enough to start her driver's education class, Eileen had already been broken in ways most people watching this story from the outside cannot even understand, with the understanding that nothing about the fact excuses what she would later to do on a Florida highway. Yet at the same time, there is a temptation with a story like Eileen's to compress the childhood into a montage and rush to the highway. Almost every previous treatment of her has been done exactly that way. The made-for-television movies, the cable specials, the big theater film, the Wikipedia paragraph that crams the abandonment, the abuse, the pregnancy in the woods into a single dense paragraph before moving on to the bodies. I'm not going to do that here. The 34 years of life that came before the first body deserves as much narrative weight as the year that produced the bodies. The story did not start at that highway. It started in the woods. Thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.